Are you working on your author career but struggling to get that first book published? Does the goal of being an author seem too lofty? Or are thoughts of having multiple books and making a full-time living are as fantastical as living in Cinderella's castle? Welcome to Discovered Wordsmiths, a podcast where aspiring authors can be heard. Join Stephen Schneider as he finds and talks to authors you may not know, but authors that have gotten their foot on the author career path. Hear what they've done to get there and where they want to go now. Settle back. It's time for a bit of inspiration and advice. Come listen to today's Discovered Wordsmith.
Hello. We're JP
and Christine,
co-host of The Serial Fiction Show. Do you like to read or write serial fiction and want to learn more? We have two podcasts, The Reader Serial Fiction Show and The Writer Serial Fiction Show.
On The Reader's podcast, we escape into a new serial each week, then interview the author to tell us more. On The Writer Serial Fiction Show, we break the serial episode down with the author and talk craft, upping our serial fiction game together. Come get lost in serial fiction and meet some amazing authors along the way to get you reading and writing serial fiction.
So hop on over to serialfictionshow.com and check it out.
We hope to see you there.
That was JP and Christine from The Serial Fiction Show. Great podcast. Whether you are a writer or a reader, they have a separate show for each one of you. So if you would like to get into serial fiction as a writer or read some of the serial fiction available, they've got something for you. Wonderful podcast. Check it out. In today's episode, I'm really excited to welcome Diane Glier. You may not recognize her name, which is why we have this podcast, to introduce you to people you may not recognize. But I was very excited to talk to Diane because she is a professor that has studied and written several books on the Inklings, which was the writer group formed by several people, including C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. And she talks a lot about the group, how they influenced each other, the benefits of how they influenced each other. It's a great conversation. Had really fun talking to her. What really got me interested in her book, it's called Bandersnatch, but I was introduced to it through Jay Thorne in his mastermind group. And he lives here in Ohio, so that gave me some interest if, you know, another Ohio author was interested in it. But also, Diane printed the book through Kent State Press, which I live like 8 miles away from. So it has a lot of Ohio connections, so I figured I'd add to that list by interviewing Diane from me. She is not in Ohio, she's out in California, but this is a really great interview. Really fun time talking to her and learned a whole lot and had a whole lot of things to think about afterwards. So enjoy the interview, and I hope it gives you a lot to think about also. Here's Diane.
My desire in writing Bandersnatch was to get outside of just the people who are familiar with Lewis and Tolkien and really reach out to creative people of all stripes and to encourage that collaborative way of working. So it's going to be great.
Yeah. So let's officially get started and feel free. If you have something really exciting and fun to share, jump in. I try and keep it casual conversation as much as possible. So it's not just back and forth questions and answers. All right, Diana, welcome to Discovered Wordsmith. I'm very excited to have you here today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. What a privilege it is to talk with you. I'm really excited about today's conversation.
Yeah. And you used to live in Ohio, so right now we've got gray skies in Northeast Ohio. So that's what you're missing right now.
I don't know that I'm missing Ohio weather, to be honest. Yeah. So I grew up outside of Cleveland and went to school at Bowling Green State University. So I've got lots of strong ties there. But I have to say, living in the Los Angeles area, the weather's a little bit nicer, I just have to say.
And I would counter that with I lived in San Diego for a while, and the weather got boring to me. I missed having rain. I missed having snow. And so honestly, I like changes in weather. I take after my grandfather. When a storm would come up, he'd grab a beer and a lawn chair and go sit in the yard and just let it rain all over. So
I get that from him, I think. Outside of writing, tell us a little bit about yourself, what you like to do.
So I am a full-time teacher at Azusa Pacific University. I'm a professor in the Honors College. And so my work is thrilling to me because it gives me an opportunity to read great books with great students. And we integrate the study of literature, history, theology, and philosophy into a four-year great book sequence. And it really is fun. Teaching is a blast. And then in addition to that, I write and publish primarily on C.S. Lewis and J.R. Tolkien. I'm enchanted with their friendship and with the way that friendship in general can be a kind of rocket fuel for our own creative process.
Which is a great philosophy, because I mentioned writer friend Jay Thorne uses your Bandersnatch book for his mastermind group and has everybody read it. And that's essentially what he's trying to emulate, that type of gathering with them. And I think I had heard vaguely a little bit about them, but then I got your book and I read your book and I'm like, oh my gosh, there's so much more here. So let's talk about that book, because you do have a couple other books, but let's talk about Bandersnatch for a moment. What got you so interested in C.S. Lewis and Tolkien and them and want to write this book about the Inklings and their gatherings?
Sure. I discovered Tolkien and the Lord of the Rings when I was still in high school. So I was part of one of those nerdy groups of students, those kids that read these fantasy novels, which at the time were very like fringy. No, you know, it wasn't mainstream interest the way it is now. We didn't have the movies and so on. So I got very interested in Tolkien, loved that, did a lot of reading when I was in high school, and was absolutely flabbergasted to discover that my two favorite authors were friends with each other. For me, it was stunning. It was like discovering that Stephen King and Shakespeare had coffee together or something. It just never occurred to me that two of the most productive and well-known authors in the world actually met together with one another twice a week. And I thought, I just wonder, what were those conversations like? What happened when Lewis and Tolkien got together in the pub, sat down with a beer, and talked together? What was the conversation like? What would it have been like, Stephen, to just think about sitting at the next table and overhearing those incredible conversations between these two creative men? And then I got to thinking, because I've always been interested in the creative process, right? What difference did their conversation make to the books that they were writing? And while I was still in high school, I started to investigate this. I thought these were key questions, and I just became fascinated with them. And I found that actually very little had been written about the subject. And so some other authors who might be listening in, when you can't find the book that you want to read, you decide that you have to write it yourself. Right. So it turned out to be harder to write, harder to investigate than I thought. So I believe it or not, it took me 23 years of research to piece together the answer to those two questions. What did they say to each other? What documentation do we have about their conversations, about their interaction, about their friendship? And then what do we know about the difference that it made to the things that they were working on? So that was my first book, a book called The Company They Keep, which demonstrated this interaction. It was a Sherlock Holmes kind of investigation. Could I find scraps of their rough drafts? Could I find evidence of their conversations? And then could I find proof positive that this conversation made a difference in the books that they were writing? And I was very excited to be able to bring that research together. But The Company They Keep is really a book for people who are total nerds about Lewis and Tolkien and who want to know just every blessed detail of their interaction, because I find that so fascinating. But Bandersnatch kind of grew out of that. And maybe one of the ways to think about Bandersnatch is that's a book that tries to answer a different question. And that question is, what can we learn from their example?
Okay, so what were some of the things that surprised you when writing this? What did you learn that you wouldn't have expected that's, oh my gosh, I can't believe that type of thing?
I'd say that one of the big ideas that I learned from this is that I had been poisoned, I would say. Poisoned is not a bad word. I'd been poisoned by the idea that the creative process is something that we take on ourselves. This idea that we have of the lone solitary genius who's in the attic and typing away on a typewriter on a dark and stormy night and pulling up ourselves by our own bootstraps and overcoming all the obstacles, a very Lone Ranger kind of image of the creative process. And I would say that my biggest discovery after now over 40 years of looking into creativity and creativity in groups is the idea that collaboration is the normal structure for creative breakthrough in practically every field that you can imagine, whether that's technology or politics or within the church, within new philosophical breakthroughs, but certainly for writers. We think of writing as being a lonely craft. But everywhere I looked, I found that behind productive and innovative writers were others who surrounded them and who played as a lot of different kinds of roles. So we think about critique groups, for example. We think about the Inklings as a critique group. And I figured that mainly the gift that they gave to one another was the gift of critique. So Tolkien would give his poem to Lewis. Lewis would say, fix this, and I didn't like this, and do this better. And what I found is that critique is a tiny fraction of what happens in a good creative group. You know that from working with a mastermind group. It isn't necessarily the critique that sustains you. For example, simply having someone else interested in your work gives you a sense of hope and anticipate accountability even.
Yes, very much.
About getting that thing done. If somebody says, oh, I'm so interested in that novel that you're working on, I'll check in with you next week and see how it's coming. Then when you wake up the next day, you think, I'd rather waste the day on a little bit of Netflix and a little bit of this or that. But you think, oh no, that person's waiting for me a week from now. And their accountability is going to make a difference in my productivity. In fact, I think it's very helpful to not think about accountability per se, but the idea of expectation. We need to surround ourselves with people who have a sense of expectation about what we're going to do, who are waiting eagerly to see what the next chapter might be, or the next discovery might be, or the next publication might be. And as we do that, we find that in those seasons where we as authors lose vision, we get discouraged, we know that somebody else is holding hope for us and can sustain that through those troubling dark times that all authors face.
Right. Yeah. And that definitely is one of the things with Jay's mastermind. Everybody supports each other. We celebrate each other's wins. Read each other's stories and help give feedback. And it's, I've got the mastermind Saturday. I have to have a win. I can't tell everybody that I watch Netflix all week. You're absolutely right.
Exactly.
It's a mindset shift. So do you think the group, particularly Lewis and Tolkien, how do you think their stories may have been different or their writing may have been different without each other to support and help?
So in Bandersnatch and also in my book, The Company They Keep, I say flat out that they would not have written what they did if it hadn't been for the influence of the group. So a couple of big examples of that may help to bring this into focus. One of them is this idea of expectation or encouragement. So Tolkien says that without the urging of C.S. Lewis, he never would have brought the Lord of the Rings to an end. Because there were two separate occasions. Like, he worked for more than 15 years on this book. That's a long time to sustain faith in a project. And we know from his letters and his diaries that there were two separate occasions where he said, I don't know where this story is going. I don't know what I'm doing. This is Hawking, right? Tolkien said, I have no more faith in this story. I'm giving up. And one of those times, he had a lunch with C.S. Lewis. We have documentation of that particular conversation. And Lewis said, no, you can't stop. We need to know where this story is going. And Tolkien would say, I don't know where this story is going. And Lewis said, that doesn't matter. Sit down and write. And Tolkien said, not going to do it. Never going to do it. I refuse. I'm finished. But as Tolkien is walking home from that lunchtime, he's thinking to himself, maybe I should give it one more shot. And then slowly he gets back into the manuscript and slowly he begins to get some traction, some momentum And then slowly the story starts to come to life before his eyes and he continues on. That happens twice in the history of the Lord of the Rings. And I think that all of us who are writers can really identify with Tolkien's sense that this is no good and I don't know what I'm doing and this is never going to sell. Or for some of us, I've gotten 40 rejection notes from publishers and agents, and I just may as well just give it up. So overcoming discouragement is one of the most important things that a writing group does for each other. But sometimes, in addition to that, we see a key idea that transforms the nature of our work. So as we explain to one another the kinds of projects that we're working on, as we discuss with one another what we're thinking, someone who knows how to ask a good question or make a good suggestion, this is different from a critique, that can sometimes be the thing that propels a work into the next stage. So again, to talk about Tolkien's example, because it's so vivid. So Tolkien did not plan to write The Lord of the Rings. Did you know that? So he wrote The Hobbit, got picked up by a publisher, and it was an instant classic. And so the publisher of The Hobbit did what all publishers do when they have a successful work. They go back to the author and they say, we need another book exactly like it, except different, right? And we have letters from Tolkien, and he wrote back and he said, I don't have anything else to say about Hobbits. I'm not going to do it. And the publisher's, please. And he's, nope. And the publisher's, oh, come on. So there, maybe it was a little bit more fancy British English than that. Right? But they go back and forth, and Tolkien says, all right, I'll give it a try. And so he writes, he starts a new story, but he doesn't really have an idea or a concept for it. So he starts writing a book he calls The New Hobbit. He's that lame in his begin, The New Hobbit. And he starts with a hobbit birthday party, Frodo and Bilbo's birthday party, fireworks, and then an escape from the Shire. And he gets about that far and he's, I am bored out of my mind with The Hobbit part. This story is going nowhere. Well, exactly. So this is another one of those times when he gets together with his friend Lewis. And Tolkien says, flat out, I'm bored to death with this. I have no idea where this story is going. It has no tension. It has no forward movement. Are you still there? You're frozen on my screen.
Oh, no, I'm still here. Can you hear me?
Okay, good. And Lewis listens. And I think that's one of the best gifts that we give each other, right? Lewis listens and then reflects. We talk about being a resonator. And then Lewis makes what I think is a brilliant observation. It's the one sentence that completely changed the entire direction of the book. Lewis says, you know what? Hobbits are only interesting when they are in un-hobbit-like situations. Hobbits are only interesting when they're in un-hobbit-like situations. And I think, so Tolkien goes home and he's mulling this sentence over and over. Hobbits are only interesting when they're in un-hobbit-like situations. That night, he rewrites a section of The Lord of the Rings. And your listeners may remember a scene where the hobbits are journeying away from the Shire and they hear hoofbeats in the distance and they hide in the roots of a tree. Very vivid scene. In the original version of that piece of the story, the rider who comes in is a rider on a white horse, and it turns out it's Gandalf returning from wherever he had been. After this conversation with Lewis, Tolkien looks at that scene again and says to himself, what would be unhobbit-like? And he rewrites the scene. The horse is not white, but black. And the rider on that horse is not Gandalf, but a black rider. And the black riders enter the story. And all of a sudden, we've kicked up the tension in the story by introducing two key questions. First of all, if this isn't Gandalf, then where is Gandalf? So you have a mystery or a tension to resolve, right? But the bigger question is, what the heck is a black rider? And why is a black rider interested in little hobbits? And all of a sudden, the story takes off. Tolkien says, at this point, the story took over. It started to take on a life of its own, a darker purpose, and a new genre. So you think about The Hobbit as a children's story, And it's basically a kind of folk tale or fairy tale. Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings is an epic. It's an epic quest. So all of a sudden, this kind of becomes a brand new thing that enchants not only us as readers, but its author. It enchants Tolkien with a new sense of purpose and, I would say, drive and curiosity. Because so often, as we're writing, whether that's nonfiction kind of scholarly work like I do, or whether that's stories, we write best when we ourselves are absorbed in trying to discover new things, a new way to express those things.
And that's telling that story, I think, is so great, because there's a lot of new authors, young authors that listen to the podcast. And first of all, if Tolkien spent 15 years writing, but only had two times when he thought, oh, I don't know what I'm doing, that's pretty impressive, because I know a lot of us have that every month. So 15 years.
Or every day.
Every day, yeah. But the other part is, I love that he was stuck. Lewis just helped him, didn't really help him so much as his observations, and that put in a different path, because I've talked to a lot of authors lately. We've heard that at times, suggestions, people saying, if you don't know where to go, Stephen King says that same thing. If you don't know where to go, blow somebody up. And that's what that is. Yeah. It's the same thing. Sure. If the story doesn't feel right, then something has to change. And I love how that's discovered that way. And I know a lot of people probably need to hear that more often, because I know I've had to do it myself. Jay looks at some of my things and talks about it, or others read it. And I'm like, okay, where's the point I need to blow somebody up?
Exactly. Some things are fascinating to us, but they're not necessarily fascinating to our readers. So one of the critiques that the Inklings made of Lord of the Rings as they were getting started is there was too much dialogue, not enough narrative. That's a very simple observation, and Tolkien resisted that advice. He said that Hobbit talk amuses me. And so since he was amused by it, he assumed everybody was going to be amused by it. But we have to write with our audience's needs in mind, not necessarily our own preferences. And so Tolkien went home and rewrote a lot of the early chapters of The Lord of the Rings. And we can document this. I love this example because it's one of those places where, as a researcher, I have proof positive that a comment made by an Inkling influenced another Inkling. So Lewis, the group got together. They said, there's too much Hobbit talk, not enough narrative. When you compare the early drafts of The Lord of the Rings to the later drafts, Tolkien cuts the dialogue by almost a third. That's a pretty big change. That's a big influence that these comments made, and it shows that critique and advice can really make a difference.
I was going to say, and for the better.
Yes.
That's what you need, that. We yes. can't always see our work. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. What were you saying?
Yeah, I was going to say, but I want to get away from the idea that the primary purpose of these groups is critique, because not everybody needs a critique group. Sometimes we just need people who can surround us, who can encourage us, who can resonate with us.
Energy.
Who can pressure us, who can be role models for us, who maybe have done this once or twice before, who can say, I've been there. This is okay. You're going to get through it. Here's what I tried. Here's what worked for me. All of these kinds of things. We also need people who simply oppose us. And this is one of the most interesting forms of feedback, who say, you know what? That's not going to work. That sounds really good, but it's not going to end up where you think it is. And who push against us. And then we either push back, right? Stronger than ever before, or we avoid a dead end because somebody else has been on that path before us and tell us where the pitfalls are, where the landmines are buried. And it means a lot to us as creatives to have other people who say, I've been there, I tried that, here's what works better. Here's what my experience has demonstrated. I talk in Bandersnatch about resonators, right? People who fundamentally understand what we're going through. And I think one of the most powerful things we can do for each other is just to companion together in the dangerous process of creating new story. People who get it, who understand what we're going through. And they don't have to give us advice. necessarily. They don't even have to warn us about pitfalls and problems. Sometimes the most powerful things that we can hear is, yeah, I know. I get that. I've been there. I felt that. And I made it through to the other side.
And the encouragement.
Yeah.
That's what people need.
Right.
I like what you said about Tolkien not wanting to write part two and the publisher saying, people like it, you need another one. Because nowadays, authors always talk about right to market. Oh, I don't want to do that. I want to write what I want to write. And they're thinking a lot of times, I want to write a Tolkien piece. I want to write Tolkien. But there it is. Tolkien was basically told, write to, you got to still write what people want to read. You got to write what they want. And if he had not written Lord of the Rings, Hobbit very well could have just been forgotten in time, maybe remembered and read in high school, but nothing beyond that. I'm not saying everybody should just do cookie cutter stories. Obviously, Tolkien didn't. Let me ask you this. How did you go about researching this and finding the information and putting them together? I know his son, Chris, has released some drafts and things. Did you ever get a chance to talk to him, or did you interview anybody who knew them? And how'd you go about all the research?
Yeah, I did get a chance to interview people who knew him. I also did correspond with Christopher Tolkien and tested out with him some of my observations. And he was very generous in answering questions for me. And so that was a really precious time. I spent most of my research in either the History of Middle Earth, that volume that Christopher Tolkien has edited, but I also went to places like the Wade Center at Wheaton College and other places, the Bodleian at Oxford, where some of these manuscripts are held. And so I've studied the notes in the margins that the Inklings wrote, studied their letters, diary entries, and then tried to piece together the narrative from all of that research. It's very time consuming, but I would look for, say, a comment from Charles Williams, who is one of their friends, about a meeting that they had, and he's maybe describing some of the advice that was given. And it's, oh, cool. Now, can I find the original draft? And then can I compare it to the published version? And do I see changes that seem to reflect the conversation that these gentlemen had together? And so I looked at that and saw over and over again that those comments, that critique, made a difference. But again, praise, encouragement, role modeling, all of these other things also come into play. You talk about mastermind groups and just sharing our collective with not having to make all of our mistakes by ourselves, hanging out with other people who get what it is that we're trying to do. Those things are all really important. And I argue that all of us need to surround ourselves with a network of folks who can help in different ways. One of the interesting things, so Lewis and Tolkien were part of a group that met twice a week, a group called the Inklings, right? 19 men over a period of 17 years met every week in Lewis's rooms at Magdalen College in Oxford to read their manuscripts out loud and critique them. And in addition, they met on Tuesday mornings at the Eagle and Child pub. So that was an informal time and was a much bigger circle. It included some of their friends, some of their students. And that group also included some women. So there was interaction of a much broader sense. But then, in addition to all that, they would get together in twos and threes for lunch or for a beer, whatever, just to talk and just to check in on each other. So the idea is that creative people need to surround themselves with others with whom they can share their struggles, their victories, and find ways to really companion together. In other words, the creative process shouldn't be lonely. We should be very intentional about finding ways to connect with others. Now, when I say that, a lot of people say, I don't even know how I'm going to find my own Inklings group. Everybody's like, where am I going to find my own Inklings circle? And what I say at the end of Bandersnatch, as you may remember, is that most powerful groups start small. They start with one person finding another person who they think might be a good companion in the journey. Two people trying the same things, two people who enjoy one another's company, but who perhaps have different personalities or different priorities, different gifts, right? Because you need a fresh perspective. And remember that the Inklings start with just Lewis and Tolkien making a simple commitment to get together once a week for lunch. That was it. Everything that we have, more than 30 books that the Inklings published, incredible works like the Chronicles of Narnia, the Screwtape Letters, Mere Christianity, Lord of the Rings, all this stuff. It's all created because two guys made a decision to start having lunch once a week. And those meetings over time became a critique group as they shared the writing that they were doing. And then it grew very slowly. They added one more person to the circle, hung out for a little bit more, another person to the circle, and it grew into this dynamic thing. But we can't start a creative writers group just bang with 30 people. It doesn't work that way. It needs to grow organically as writers make a commitment to spend time investing in one another. And what I believe with all my heart, based on all of this research that I've done, is if we start investing in one another, we will find our own work flourishing at a level we never imagined, because we truly do need the dynamic interaction that comes when creative people get together, argue, give advice, question, lean into each other's work. In other words, my own productivity soars when I find others that I can invest in. And then in turn, they begin to invest in me.
And absolutely. And as you talk about community, one of the guys in the mastermind has stated he discovered that he needs to be part of a community. And he quit a job and found a different job so he could have more time to write. And so he could have more. And he started doing co-writing and he's doing a podcast. So he said, that's how I have to create. So you're absolutely right on with that from, you know, all everything we've experienced in our own mastermind. And you must have read these stories dozens and dozens of times, pieces here and there and out of orders. I remember in high school, every year you're given that list and you got to make book reports. And the teacher handed us the list, and the last books on the list were the Tolkien trilogy and The Hobbit. And she said, but I wouldn't recommend anybody do that because that was my master's thesis and I know them inside and out. So of course that's what I, and what cracked me up was she gave me a B minus because she marked some things wrong and I got the book and showed her, look, what I wrote is exactly what's in the book. She goes, I'm not even going to look at that because I know I'm right. And I'm like, oh my gosh, are you kidding me?
Oh, so no.
I could have had an A on that, but she was too stubborn to listen. So it's good to talk to what I would consider an even more expert than just my old English. And I hope she doesn't listen to this because she might hunt me down. I don't want that either. Diana, what are, besides the Tolkien and the Lewis and that, what are some of your other favorite books that you like? I see a whole bunch of books behind you. So what are some other books you like to read?
Oh gosh, I am an English teacher, so I do read all kinds of different things. Most of my reading right now really is related to my teaching. In a Great Works program, we spend a lot of time reading things like Dante's Divine Comedy and Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. So most of the reading that I do is not reading for pleasure, unfortunately, but it is reading that's related to the teaching that I do. But there are lots of different kinds of books. I'm not primarily a fiction reader, although there are stories that I truly enjoy. And like a lot of the Inklings, when I do have the leisure to read fiction, I really like cozy mysteries. Laurie King's stories are one category that I really like. But I don't read a lot of fiction other than Inklings-related work. Mostly what I'm really fascinated with is nonfiction. And a lot of the books on the shelf are books that have to do with the creative process. And this is something that I've been investigating and researching for a long time because I'm personally fascinated with what happens in between the moment that you get an idea, the spark of an idea, and then the finished product is sent out into the world. What is that in between? What's that black box, that mysterious thing that happens in terms of the writing process? One of the books I love that talks about the creative process in this highly interactive way is an account of Pixar and Disney and their creative process, a book called Creativity Inc. Are you familiar with that?
I've got it in my library. I just opened it up last night and was reading through a little bit of it because I've got so many books I'm trying to look at and read and get info from because I just had some things happen. And I hit one of those breakthrough revelation moments. So I'm like, okay, I got to read this. And anyway, that's one of the books, yes, on my short list to read very soon.
Yes, I think every writer should read that. And again, they just demonstrate how it is that this synergy happens as people gather, as they talk, as they argue, as they confront one another, as they ask great questions, and how that collaboration elevate the relevance and the beauty, the skill, the quality of the work that's being produced. It's a fantastic book, and it's a great read too.
Yeah, and Pixar movies are super for story structure because they pretty much give you the template for writing a good story in various ways, and I think they're perfect for that. The creative process, is that a hint to the next book you're working on that we'll see?
I am talking with a novelist right now, actually, about taking some of the ideas in Bandersnatch and then applying them more specifically to creative writers, to world building, and trying to get into more detail on them. My most recent book was a book that I edited that's about C.S. Lewis's science fiction stories. So many people aren't aware that he wrote 3 science fiction novels, but a lot of people find those novels a little bit hard to digest. They're fairly complex in some of their symbols and some of their references. Lewis assumes we're a lot smarter than we actually are. And so I worked with a wonderful team of scholars to write a book called A Compass for Deep Heaven. And that's my newest book, my newest publication, just about a month ago. So people who are interested in C.S. Lewis as a science fiction writer might find that helpful. The next book coming up is a book called Journey Back Again, Reasons to Revisit Middle Earth. And this is a book that tries to argue one time through Lord of the Rings isn't enough, that there's a lot that Tolkien does, not only in his world building, but in his storytelling, that we miss in that immersive experience of just reading Lord of the Rings the first time or watching the movies through one time or two times. And it looks a little bit deeper into Tolkien's own gifts as a storyteller and as a world builder. So that book should come out in another year and a half or so, but that's the current project.
Oh, I'll definitely look for that. I'll put some links up to your other books too in the show notes.
I'd love
to read some of them. Yeah. And you mentioned about the C.S. Lewis science fiction being complicated, hard to understand. I must say, Return of the King was not the easiest read for me ever. it was a difficult read, especially because Hobbit, like you said, was a kid's book, very light and easy. Fellowship was similar to that. But then the next two definitely got probably closer to something like Dune, where it takes some thinking and almost struggle to keep up with it sometimes. They are much deeper books.
Yes. There's a story that helps me when I'm thinking about Tolkien as a creative writer. So one of the things that C.S. Lewis and his brother Warren Lewis really enjoyed was going for walks, walking for miles, 10, 20 mile long walks across the English countryside and then winding up in a pub somewhere after a long day of hiking. And they invited Tolkien to come along with them a couple of times. And what they discovered is the problem with going hiking with Tolkien is he stopped at every interesting leaf or plant or tree. And he'd walk 10 feet and he'd go, oh my God, look at that tree. Look at its form. Look at it. Walk a few more. Oh, look at the leaves and how they shimmer in the light. And C.S. Lewis and his brother just look at each other. It's, we're never going to get anywhere because he's so into the environment, right? The location. He's fascinated with all this. And this goes back to what we said a few minutes ago, that Tolkien himself had his own amusements, the things he was amused by, the things he was enchanted by, the things that he loved. But if we're going to write and we're going to write, we can't write just according to our own taste. We have to take into account the tastes of others. And I don't think that means compromise. But when we're writing short story or a novel or even a scholarly book, we have to take into account what are other people wanting to hear? And not only that, what do they need to hear in order for my message to come across clearly? And we can't just write for our own amusement. That's what we do in our journals, and that's what we do in our diaries. There are situations where we are the audience for our own work. But if we want our work to have a broader appeal, if we want people to buy our books, we have to write in a way that we are bridging the gap between what's happening in our head and what's happening in the minds and the hearts of the people who read what we do. So Stephen King talks about this in his wonderful book about the writing process. He talks about the magic trick, right? Mm-hmm. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Where he says the magic trick of an author is the ability for them to imagine something and communicate it so vividly that the same image comes alive in the mind and the heart of the reader. And there is something wonderfully magic about that, isn't there? But in order to do that, we can't be self-absorbed or self-obsessed. We can't say, as some of my students want to say, I know what I mean, or I thought that scene was fascinating, or I love that long conversation smack in the middle of my action story. We can't do that. We have to be more sensitive and more thoughtful. I don't think that's compromise. I think that's entering into the kind of dynamic relationship that an author ought to have with one's readers.
Absolutely. And I would say, I'm not saying I'm a great writer. I'm not Stephen King, Tolkien, or anything like that. But I love the story about Tolkien because obviously he wrote the way he actually lived. How he takes a walk is how he wrote. But I would argue that you could write whatever you want in any way you want, but it's pointless art if nobody reads it. So there's no point in writing it in a way that nobody wants to read because it's not appreciated. It doesn't help anybody. It doesn't do anything for the world. But doing your art and being able to make it approachable by others, that makes it more successful as the art, as writing or pictures or whatever. That's not my own thought. That's stuff I've read, picked up from others, which you backed up right there.
I think of it in terms of being invitational. I want my writing to be very invitational. So even my most scholarly work has to be a kind of medium place where I can meet with the reader and we can be having the same experience together. As a writer, like many writers, I find it very helpful to have journals and to have notebooks and to have scraps where I am working out things for myself. But to me, that's very different than the transactional process that I think writers have to master in order to really connect with readers.
I agree, totally. Diana, it has been super great. You have probably put so much information in here for writers that I'm probably going to have to make sure I tell my mastermind group and everybody to listen to this because there's just so much in there that you talked about. But is there anything else, and I know this is probably pulling it, but is there any other advice you would give to a new writer, somebody that's listened to this whole interview and all these great things that you've said, anything others to give them advice, tell them what, you know, to look forward to, what to do or anything like that?
I would say that this idea that we can write in community, in connection with one another, is something that's not only more vital than it's ever been before, but also easier than it's ever been before because of the advantages of doing what we're doing now, talking online, connecting in this way, even finding out about each other and discovering some of the overlaps in our worlds and in our interests. So it's not as hard and scary as you think, I would say to new writers. And I would encourage you to just try to start small with little reaching out, having conversations, and starting to begin the process of immersing yourself in this larger world. One easy way to get started with that, and one of the most inspiring things that a new writer can do, is think about finding a writer's conference. And there are lots of them, and they're everywhere. And I remember my first writer's conference. So I have a PhD in writing, in composition. And I'd already published a couple of books when I went to my first writer's conference. And I thought, oh, this is going to be great because I'm going to pick up a couple of tips that might be helpful for me. My mind was blown. I felt like I was getting a graduate education in what it looks like to be a writer, because here I was with a couple hundred other people who were doing what I was doing, who understood what my questions were, who had made discoveries, big and small, that transformed my own experience as a writer. Try to find some writers' conferences. Find writers' conferences that are in the genres that you're interested in and attend. And writers can be shy. So when you attend those events, make it your goal to reach out past your comfort zone and talk to as many people as you possibly can. And I think that's one of the most transformative beginnings for people who want to try to taste what it's like to become a writer in community.
I absolutely agree. Jay and Zach had they called it a summit planned for last year, but because of COVID, it got shifted to this year. And there was something like 120, 130 people signed up. But when they shifted it to this year, they couldn't have as many local. So I think this is probably going to be the norm, but there were like 40 people that showed up, and then everybody else was on Zoom calls. So it was a very small, intimate conference. There wasn't a person that left it without being, oh my gosh, I am like so jazzed and fired up right now. And we talked about it. Last week at our meeting, it was 3 weeks down the road, and we were still mentioning it and how much we got out of it and learned. I couldn't even tell you everything that was said at the talks. It was in the room, the energy and talking to people, yes, like you said. And it, yes, wasn't one of the huge ones that had 3,000 people. It was small, yes, and intimate. And Jay said he liked that. And he's very much thinking of doing another small one next year. So here's hoping.
That's brilliant. I think the most important thing for me to emphasize is becoming a better writer isn't just a matter of better information. I love podcasts. I think they're great. We can get great information from a podcast. I love books. I hope everyone will continue to read about the creative process and learn more from books. But something magic happens when we get together face to face. It changes us in a way that nothing else does. There is a dynamic energy that happens that motivates us, that heals us, that moves us forward exponentially. And we need to make time for that. People say, oh, I don't have time to go to a conference. I don't have time to get together at one of these events, or I don't have time to meet with my mastermind group. And if you don't understand, you are going to take quantum leaps forward if you stop trying to struggle on your own, piece it together by yourself. We are made, I believe, to flourish in community. We thrive not only when we receive encouragement, but when we give it. Not only when we receive critique and opposition and challenge, but when we give those things. And it's in that dynamic interaction that so much of our creativity is awakened. And I love that process. And I can't speak highly enough of the need for each of us to find those groups, not just one, but several different kinds of groups that help to propel us to the next level.
Absolutely. And I totally agree with that. Diana, I won't keep you all day. I probably could sit here and talk with you for quite a while. This has been great. I do appreciate your time and your wonderful books. So thank you very much for being on the podcast.
My pleasure. It's been a joy.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Discovered Wordsmiths. Come back next week and listen to another author discuss the road they've traveled, and maybe, sometime in the near future, it might be you.